85% of the neural messages in your brain originates in this clump of structures that we refer to as the limbic system. This is the emotional part of the brain. Only 15% comes back the other way from the sort of the executive prefrontal cortex part of the brain. And so what does that mean? It means that change is difficult. I mean, people talk a lot about change. We're going to change the way we do things at the lumber mill. I'm going to change the way I think about my brain. We're going to change the software that we all use. We're going to change the voting system in Canada. Well, good luck. I mean, change is important. It's good for the brain, but it's a lot more difficult than most people think.
Hello, I'm John Brink, and we are podcasting on the Brink from downtown Prince George, British Columbia, Canada. And for all those people watching us from around the world and saying, oh, we know that British Columbia is in Canada, obviously, but how about Prince George? Well, Prince George is about 500 miles north of Vancouver, or for friends in Europe, about 800 kilometers. And then also Prince George is the center of British Columbia. So British Columbia is a big, big province. Now, we have a special guest also from British Columbia today, who is from Vancouver, or more precisely, Surrey, British Columbia, close to Vancouver. And his name is Terry Small, and they call him the Brain Guy. Now, this is going to be a very interesting podcast because Terry has a Bachelor of Education and a Master's of Teacher in Canada, leading learning and skills specialist, and potentially as it relates to anything to do with the brain, I would say. He's also the author of The Brain Bulletin with over 34,000 subscribers around the world. He has an amazing list of, he's an author, he has a list of clients that is probably 10 pages long, too far to list. But he's an amazing individual with an amazing background. Terry, this is going to be an interesting podcast. Welcome to my show.
Great to be here, John. And I love Prince George. I've been there many times for work. It's always fun to be up north. And I'm delighted to be here to join you and your guest today.
So, Terry, tell us about your background. Where did you, preferably where were you born, where did you study, and then where is your practice other than virtually, globally, I believe. But tell us a little bit about that so we get a better idea about you and your specialty, obviously.
Well, that's a great question. I wasn't exactly expecting you to kind of start me off at the beginning, but interestingly enough, that was one of the brain bulletins that I sent out. Something that a lot of people don't know about me is that I attended a one-room schoolhouse on the west coast of Vancouver Island, and Mrs. McLean taught everything from grade 1 through grade 8, all in one room. And I think, John, that I think it's relevant because that's where my love of learning, I think, was born, because I was in grade 1, and I was the only student in grade 1. So I was quite fond of telling everybody that I was the top of my class in everything. And my brother would pipe up and say, "Yeah, but you're also the bottom." And he was right, because I was the only one. But I used to love to finish up my lessons early, because then I could eavesdrop on Mrs. McLean telling the older children stories about history, interesting things. And she always knew I was eavesdropping, but she never let on. And so I had the benefit in those early years of you know, being in 7 or 8 grades all at the same time. And so I guess it was inevitable I would end up pursuing that. And I did a couple of degrees in education and applied neuroscience and learning strategies. And eventually I wound up on the Brink podcast.
Now, your education, so again, for our guests watching us from around the world and saying that British Columbia is a big province and Canada is big, it is not uncommon here to see small communities that because they are so far removed from great dissenters that they had in those days, and still now to, in some cases, probably very small school systems where you would have grade 1 to grade 8 was not totally uncommon then. And obviously it gave you and then others a very good exposure, but at the same time it brought you then into, I presume, the university. Did you go to the University of British Columbia?
Yes. Yeah, so then after we were, the little town was actually called Esperance. It was on the west coast of Vancouver Island, about 50 people. There were no roads. The only place in was by boat or seaplane.
And so then we moved. Close to where we have a place in North Saanich on Vancouver Island, close to Victoria.
Well, if you were to go to Tofino yeah. and then take
beautiful
a boat
place.
And go straight up, okay. We're halfway between Tassis and Zabalas.
Yeah. So, and that's the whole point. It was a small community on a beautiful island, and Vancouver Island, actually, and big. And so that's where the community was. Okay.
Yeah, and there wasn't a lot to do except learn and read books. And then we moved to Richmond. And then to your question, John, I did attend the University of British Columbia.
Right.
I got a degree in education, and I enrolled my first class at the age of 21 and loved it, just absolutely loved it. Honestly, it was, for me, learning and teaching students was so much fun. I they'd come along and said, we can't pay you anymore. I probably would have continued to do it. I really enjoyed it.
Right.
And then I went back and I got a master's degree in advanced learning strategies. And then that took me up to spending some time teaching at the high school. And then I returned to teach at UBC. So I came full circle. I ended up working at UBC as an instructor for quite a number of years, as well as a number of other post-secondary places as well.
And so that brings us to where, what do you do now? Because the bio, the brain guy, and then, you know, there is nothing more fascinating to a lot of people than we don't not understand much of the most important organ that we all have, how it functions and what does it do. And how did you get to that specialty and became really an amazing master in that field that a lot of people around the world listen to you, and you've obviously give steadily presentations on that particular topic.
Well, you're right. I've just been blessed. I've had a chance to travel all over the world and talk to people about their brains and learning. But specifically, I can tell you how it happened. I really had a heart for working with students that were troubled and students that were just not really meant for the public education system. And was having a lot of success with them. And, you know, I would get all the students that everybody else had pretty much given up on. And we were having so much success that people started to notice, and other schools would kind of say, hey, well, what are you doing with those kids? And could you come and talk to, you know, our parents and so forth? And I can remember very clearly one session very early on. A gentleman came out of the audience afterwards and he said, that was great. He said, I'm so glad I came tonight. He said, you know, everything that you're talking about would be of tremendous value to my employees. And he identified himself and his company in Vancouver. And he said, you speak to organizations and businesses. And I kind of quickly thought, I said, well, yeah, sure, I can do that, never having done it before. And anyway, to make a long story short, I went and spoke to his organization, and it went very, very well. And then that led to something else and to something else. And before I knew it, this whole thing happened organically. I never thought that I was ever going to be, you know, a public speaker in this area. I was doing what I loved. And I love your question, John, because so often I get people after a session, they'll come out of the audience and they say, okay, what do I have to do? Because I'd love to be able to do something like what you're doing. And my response really has never changed much over the years. It's not so much what do you have to do, it's who do you have to become. You know, you'd have to love your topic, and just, you really need to become your topic. And so that has led me all over the world. And to be honest, I'm not even sure how we connected. Probably you heard me speak somewhere, or somebody's heard me speak and mentioned it to you, but it's all been organic.
Yeah, it could be PodMatch potentially, on podcasting. Now, what I just hear you say is that, I find your interest, your topic is so interesting and so timely and always has so many questions around it. So to make it interesting, I'll give you a case that is called John Brink. At least as a project. I was born in 1940, so I will be 84 this year. 84 years young, I call it. And I was born in northeastern Holland. I know you're familiar with that, or at least with Holland, because you've been there likely many times. And I was born during the start of the Second World War, and things were... my parents were in love, got married in 1938, and were looking forward to a career, and they were a happy couple as they are in love, and they had a son fairly quickly, and then a daughter, and then I was born in November, November the 1st, 1940. Very early in their relationship, the Second World War had already started in 1938-39, but then Holland got invaded by the German Nazi Blitzkrieg that drafted my dad, had to go into the Dutch army, and all of a sudden everything that was so beautiful and so started changed. The last time they heard from him was in, during the bombing of Rotterdam, and for 5 years they didn't know if he was dead or alive. So things were very, very tough and very, very difficult. The first thing that I remember is bombers, thousands of them, in 1943 to 1944, 45. The other part that I remember is that, the hunger winter, and then they had cut off all the food flowing into most of Holland. So I remember the hunger winter as well as the coldest winter on record. And we as little kids at, my brother, my sister, myself, every morning we would go out with gunny sacks into the railroad yard and pick up anything edible and burnable. And so we saw far too much that we should not have seen. It was a difficult, difficult time. There was a lot of anxiety and hunger. I can still feel the hunger. I can still, even now, still feel the cold. And obviously had PTSD as well as the inner child issues, got counseling for that well into my 50s, actually. We were liberated by the Canadian Army April the 12th, 1945. I always knew from that point forward I would go to the land of my heroes. And I wanted to go when I was 17, and my parents wouldn't let me then. And then I was drafted into the Dutch Air Force, was there for 2 years, and then worked in the lumber industry. My dad had worked in the lumber industry. My grandfather was a master carpenter. So I knew I wanted to go to Canada. I wanted to go to British Columbia. I wanted to build a lumber mill. Now, academically, I was not a success story in Holland. I failed grade 3, and I failed grade 7 3 times. And so... my parents were beautiful people, but then it was suggested to them, what are we going to do with this guy? Saying, well, maybe we'll send him to the mentally challenged school. Now, fortunately, they didn't do that, and they decided to he should learn a trade. And you know, my dad had connections with a furniture factory, so at 13, I started working at a furniture factory. I loved the lumber and all those other things, and then I went to school to become a furniture maker in college, and then was already becoming successful in the lumber industry. And hold on, before I left when I was 23, and so I left Holland, I felt that I had failed, you know, because all my friends that were growing to grade 7 with me, you know, went to college, then university, and I became a laborer. I'm proud of that today, but then I wasn't, you know, although I was very optimist and always already entrepreneurial, even in a different way, but it always kind of stayed with me. And I kind of felt I had to not only go to the land of my heroes and prove to me that I could do it, but also have the dream of building a lumber mill. And so when I arrived in Montreal, I took the train across Canada, arrived in Vancouver in July of 1964, 65, went to the immigration office. I couldn't speak English, didn't know a soul, didn't have a job. But when I went to the immigration office in Vancouver, fortunately there was a German fellow that I could speak some German, and I told him what I wanted to do. He said, I told him that I wanted to build a lumber mill. He said, go to Prince George. That's where is the boom town, and that's where they're building sawmills, and you know all about that. And so I went to Prince George, came off the bus here, you know, the bus ride, Greyhound bus ride. I'm close to it, actually, about 2 or 3 blocks away from here. So I came off the bus. I had one suitcase, 3 books, 2 sets of clothes, and I had, in my money, and I counted my money, and standing there by the bus station, and I had $25.47. But I had a dream, and the other positive that I had is that attitude, you know, that no matter how tough things are, I know always tomorrow will be better, and that's always the way I've been. The other one is passion, that if I find somebody I like, I give it 150%. And then the other one is work ethic. I work harder than anybody. I usually get up at 5:30 in the morning, and I always think I'm late. I always make my bed. And so that's how I started here. Now, the point that I was going to make, and that's why I'm telling this story, and there was one more thing that what changed my life is the war, the meeting of the Canadian Army, and knowing that I was going to the land of my heroes, then actually going to Canada and British Columbia to build my mill. And then, but even then still, I felt that a feeling of that I had was something was missing. I had failed even then still. And already when I started building the things that I did, I still did not feel, people would say, oh, you're so successful and all the, I didn't feel that way. And then one event that also was a life changer for me, I went into a bookstore. I was here already for 32 years, and I picked up a book, and the book's title was Driven to Distraction. And it was written by Dr. Halliwell. And I opened the book. I still don't know why I picked it up. And it was about ADHD. And I said, oh my God, that's me. And so then I became aware of ADHD, and the more I learned about it and Google and all the other places, and it took me even 5, I thought it was the stigma attached, implying that it was a mental defect of some description. It took me 5 years to go see my doc that had delivered our two daughters and was a personal friend. It was 1962 that I walked in his office, and and I was already 62 years old. And he said, "Hey, John, why are you here?" I said, "I think I got ADHD." And so we checked it out. Yes, I do. The more I found out about it, in Google and other things, it became clearer and clearer to me is that, there is no question about it. And I believe it is a superpower. But it explained a lot of things that had going on.
Yeah.
So from the time, and that's why I'm laying it out for you, is from the time that I was 13 and knowing that all the other people had succeeded, there was something not right with me. It was implied that I was dumb and stupid and failed and all those things. I didn't believe that. I believed that I was just as good as all the other ones, but I didn't make the connection. It took me 50 years till 1962, between 13 and 1962, for all intents and purposes, 50 years until all of a sudden one click. And it became for me a superpower. It unlocked a lot of things, including now this is not a ura, John, but I'm just laying it in front of you because these are all issues that I believe you relate to, is that I became quite successful. We have 10 different companies. I've written already 4 books. I'm working on 2 other ones. I'm an in-demand public speaker and keynote speaker. I'm active in podcasting, all of that. And so all because of that unlocking that and still carrying that with me and then finding that I was always a good writer, even in school. I was good with numbers, but the system said that I failed, it doesn't bother me now other than to say I will do whatever I can to speak of the issues of how it does affect people and to become more clarity, in particularly around ADHD and other issues. I wrote one book about it. Is this one, ADHD Unlocked.
Yeah.
And quite popular, actually. And so I want to share that with you, and so that's who you're with today.
Well, what an amazing story, John. It's a very, very inspiring. I mean, you sound an awful lot like the students that I would have worked with. And, it's interesting that so often, one of the things that I like to tell people is you're never more than one idea away from a massive breakthrough in any area of your life. And that's why I'm an avid reader. I mean, for years I taught the speed reading program at UBC and also for the Vancouver School Board. And I would tell people, I'd say, look, it doesn't matter whether you're trying to fix a relationship or whether you're trying to understand yourself or get a job promotion, you're never more than one idea away from a massive breakthrough in any area of your life. And so it's so important to have good conversations, to talk to people, to read good books. I love your story because it reminded me that I too picked up a book when I was very, very young and very early. I'll be honest with you, I was frustrated with a lot of the students that I was working with. We'd all love to have students who are sponges and sit there and listen to everything we have to say and essentially are teacher pleasers. But, a lot of kids aren't like that. So I happened to pick up a book called Frames of Mind by the late Dr. Howard Gardner from Harvard. And Howard Gardner, first of all, says that, and this was just so important to me because it changed the picture in my brain. He said that ADHD or ADD does exist, but it's not a disorder. It's not a disability. He called it a difference. It is an attention difference. And so that put a different picture in my brain. And then he went on to describe how in his work at Harvard that he had identified seven, not just that the normal intelligences that school evaluates and values, quite frankly. He identified seven intelligences, and you obviously have quite a few of those. And before he passed away, I think he was up to 12 different intelligences. And one of the things he said, John, is that schools, whether they be in Holland or here in Canada, when I first started out, and I think to some extent even now, he said that schools tend to value linguistic intelligence, mathematical intelligence, and intrapersonal intelligence, kids who can sit still for long periods of time and not be disruptive and listen to the teacher. They tend not to value the interpersonal, which is probably, you're very strong in interpersonal intelligence. Although the kids that can't sit still and they have a hard time not talking, they tend to be blurters in class. Spatial intelligence, physical intelligence, musical intelligence. And then I followed that book up with another amazing book, because that really kind of changed the picture in my brain. I thought, okay, I got to learn more about this. And I read a book called Seven Kinds of Smart by Dr. Thomas Armstrong, which built on Howard Gardner's frames of mind and his seven intelligences. And it changed the picture in my brain about the students that I was working with. And those pictures, John, are massive. I tell people that there's everybody that's involved with this podcast right now, you, me, all the listeners, Scott and Andrew, we all came into this session and our brains have a picture of itself. Now, I actually brought my brain with me. I have quite a number of these in my office. And you think you have trouble getting through airport security? I've chosen to have a sense of humor about it when I go to the airport, but
yeah,
they always pull me out of the lineup and I allow an extra 15 minutes. But all of us have a picture of, our brains have a picture of itself, what it's good at, what it's not good at, what will work, what won't work. Nothing changes until the picture changes.
Right.
So whenever I do a lot, like you, I do a lot of presentations and I talk to a lot of people about various aspects of applied neuroscience. And there's three things that really never change. Three principles that, if you like, form an equilateral triangle that kind of hold our thoughts together about the brain. Number one, here's something for you to try and for anybody right now who's listening live. Everybody just close your eyes for a moment. Just close your eyes. Think of an apple. Please open your eyes. What color was the apple? What color was your apple, John?
Orange, jello.
Okay. So notice you didn't see the letters APPLE floating nowhere in space. I said, think of an apple. You saw an image of an apple. So maybe for many people listening, for the first time in your life, you realize that your brain thinks in pictures first, and then the words come. Everybody, just try it again. Close your eyes, please. Think of a horse. Open your eyes, you probably saw an image of a horse. Not everybody, but most people, the first thing will be a picture, and then the words come and the dialogue comes, but the picture drives the dialogue. And those pictures are incredibly important. That's actually how we remember best. You'll never walk down the street out there in downtown Prince George and go up to somebody and go, you know, I remember your name, but your face escapes me. You always remember that face because it's a picture. The name, not so much because it is a word. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. The brain thinks in pictures. Nothing changes until the picture changes. If you think that you have a learning disability rather than a learning difference, that's your ceiling. You never outperform. And so when you were giving us your life story, you were talking about how you manage that picture in your brain. Interestingly enough, too, John, when you saw your orange apple, what do you see with? You see with your brain, not your eyes. Specifically, this part of the brain back here, It's called right. the occipital lobe. Metaphorically, we call it the mind's eye, and that is a big, big deal because the sort of second part of our equilateral triangle, the second point on this triangle is, I'm assuming that everybody on this podcast is here because they have a love of learning. And so here is, I think, the best definition of learning you are ever going to hear in your life. Learning, for the most part, is connecting new information to what you already know. And what you already know is almost always going to be produced first as a picture. So the third point of our equilateral triangle is this, and this is one of the most important discoveries about the brain in the last 400 years. Thinking is a process of electrical chemical reaction. You know this. So you probably have a to-do list, John. You seem like the kind of person that have a to-do list. You get up in the morning, check things off as you get things done. Do you have a to-do list, by the way?
Mentally.
Okay. Yeah, me too. Now, number one on my to-do list never changes. Hit the snooze button once. Unless the house is on fire, the opportunity clock goes off. I hit the button. I still use an old school analog clock. So the sound goes off. I hit the snooze button. That's the first thing on my to-do list. Yeah. You've probably noticed though, John, your brain also has a to-do list. And it's different than your to-do list. If you ever got to the bottom of a page and go, I wonder what I just read, or you come parachuting back into a meeting and go, I wonder what they've been talking about for the last 5 minutes. That's your brain pursuing its own to-do list. And number one on my to-do list never changes, snooze button once. Number one on my brain's to-do list, which is different than my to-do list, never changes, and is the same as yours and everybody in this podcast, and that is to keep you alive. 85% of the neural message in your brain originates in this clump of structures that we refer to as the limbic system. This is the emotional part of the brain. Only 15% comes back the other way from the sort of the executive prefrontal cortex part of the brain. And so what does that mean? It means that change is difficult. I mean, people talk a lot about change, and we're going to change the way we do things at the lumber mill. I'm going to change the way I think about my brain. We're going to change the software that we all use. We're going to change the voting system in Canada. Well, good luck. I mean, change is important. It's good for the brain, but it's a lot more difficult than most people think. So when it comes to you, when it comes to students that I worked with, when it comes to anybody listening here, the first thing that has to change is the picture. I mean, you look at the pictures on your phone. Sometimes you look at the pictures in your family album. When was the last time that we thought we sat in a quiet place and we flipped through the pictures in our brain and decided, where did that come from? Do I need to change that picture? I sure didn't put that there. And so that's essentially what drives my work and my love of my work is changing the pictures in people's brains, because learning is connecting new information to what you already know. So if you see yourself as, I loved, John, when you said that your particular way of paying attention to the world is a superpower. Because thoughts are physical forces, and that's what you're going to experience when you go out into the world. If for example, a student that I was working with saw themselves as being a failure, as being dumb, or nobody likes me, when they go out into the world, that's the only thing that's going to stick.
Yeah.
Nothing changes until the picture changes. So one of the things I like to do in my classes and the sessions, I like to get people paired off. And one of the things that they do, one of the red threads that kind of runs through our sessions is you are a genius. They'll turn to the person beside them, their partner, and they'll say, you know, you're a genius. And they'll do that at least 25 times in a session. And they always laugh the first time because when I say genius, who's the first genius that pops into your mind, John? I say genius. Who pops into your mind?
Genius, some of the people that I admire, that I've read books about like you have, Dr. Halliwell is one likely, Management by Drucker is one, number of other things that I've listened to and I've guided me and my knowledge likely.
Yeah, and I have a whole list as well. I can't remember where I read this, but I remember there was a survey done where they just went out and they just randomly asked 100 people to name a genius, and 95 of them said Albert Einstein. I always find it interesting in my sessions when the first time they turn to their partner and say, you're a genius, they all laugh. Incoming information from the environment, first thing the brain does, it pulls up a picture of somebody like Albert Einstein, and then the dialogue is driven by the picture, and the little voice says, well, you know, I'm no Albert Einstein, and people laugh. That's typically why people laugh when they're uncomfortable, as the brain will usually produce the laughter response as a way of releasing chemicals that make the brain comfortable and so forth. But I love the definition that William James, the founder of psychology in 1852 at Harvard, he said, genius is the art of non-habitual thinking. And I love that he used the word art. He said, genius is the art of non-habitual thinking. And so when people are trying to affect change, whether they're trying to overcome some pictures that were put in their brain when they were attending school in Holland, and they want to do something different with their lives, like build a lumber mill and write books and do all the amazing things that you've done, that picture has to change. And I find it so interesting that you opened up that book and used different words, but you were basically saying, my mind's eye shifted, and I started to see and experience the world differently. Because we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are.
Yeah. So, in fact, what you're saying is that time has given you a picture of who you are, and that unless you, in a deliberate way, start addressing those issues, either through consultation or in some other form, or doing it by books that I picked up, that you picked up, or other things that we are exposed to, it changes the picture. The combination. The other thing that I find amazing, I have an amazing memory, even at 84, and I do that. I have energy, all those other kind of things that are good qualities. But having seen a lot of stuff and then being exposed to the feeling of failing, because the learning system was such that it could easily go in that direction. But I was always an optimist and always stayed positive by nature. Is that helpful?
Yeah, it's extremely, extremely helpful. Going back to your opening remarks when you were describing, you know, your life, that's the very definition for me of positivity. I mean, being positive doesn't mean you have to be happy all the time. I mean, that's not real. I don't know anybody who's like that. But I think, to me, positive thinking is even when we're having a bad day or a bad week, maybe even a bad year, deep down somewhere you realize that there's better days coming. You know, going back to the label, and you have it right on the cover of your book, you know, ADD. Now, I realize it's a clinical term. Sometimes there's funding attached to it. And so we often hear it referred to as attention deficit disorder. That said, be careful of the picture that you put in your brain, because thoughts are physical forces, and they change the very wiring in your brain. And so Howard Gardner, and I remember this so very clearly, he in his book, I think in chapter one of Frames of Mind, he says that it's really a cultural bias, because in Dutch society and Canadian society, schools value mathematical intelligence, linguistic intelligence, and intrapersonal intelligence. And then he used the example of another culture, and the one I think he used was French Polynesia, where those, you know, historically, those intelligences were not valued. They valued probably a lot of the things that you were naturally brilliant at, connecting with people, interpersonal intelligence. Physical intelligence, being able to build things with your hands and see how things are put together and how the physical world works. and also spatial intelligence, being able to navigate at nighttime by looking at the stars. And he used that example. So he said that if you were to take our students, who sometimes are seen as gifted, and you put them in that culture, they would be considered disabled. And if you took students there and brought them here, it would flip as well. And then he used a really interesting example. He used an example of a professor that had an advanced degree in something or other. And he was driving his car, and his car stopped working. And there was a farmer plowing a field next door with his tractor, and the farmer came over and fixed his car. And so Howard Gardner's point was, in that situation, who was the disabled person? Was it the person with a PhD in something? Exactly. Or was it? And so he said that it's really critical that we think in those terms, because those pictures are, they matter. They're very, very important. So one of the things I did when I was with the first thing we have to do is we have to change the picture. We had amazing success with those students. Some of them went on to be politicians, lawyers. One of them, like you, John, I bumped into him a while back in a pub. And I've been at this long enough now that he was probably 50 years old. And he goes, hey, Mr. Small, remember me? You taught me. And he said, he was just, I remember at the time, I loved him. He's one of those kids I loved. But honestly, he was a lot of work. He was never in his seat. He was always talking out of turn. His desk was a mess. He never turned his homework in. But he was one of those kids that he had a sparkle in his eye. He had a good sense of humor. But it was like having 10 kids in one in your classroom. It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Anyway, he said, I'm glad I bumped in. He says, because I wanted to thank you for everything you did for me in grade six. He says, you didn't fail me. And he said, I just want you to know I still have a messy desk. But that's okay. I've got an assistant that tidies everything up for me. And he says, I want you to know I still can't sit still for more than 5 minutes, but that's okay, he says, because my job is just roaming around the world talking to people. And then he said that he'd started a company where he sells very familiar products that you would see all over the world to governments, and he's in the construction industry. And I won't say too much more than that because I don't have his permission to tell his story, but I was inspired because I thought, my gosh, there's somebody who came out of school. He had a picture in his brain that, okay, I'm gonna figure this out. I'm gonna do what I love. I mean, brains are amazing because you actually change the very wiring in your brain with the thoughts that you have.
Right.
You physically change your brain by your thought pattern.
Exactly. Now, that then being said, Terry, a lot of times what I find is, the speaking to a lot of younger people, either in high schools or colleges, even university, or whatever I speak to, a lot of times I find that, in a general sense in particular, that people are not awfully happy with the way they look, the way they dress, and that they have developed the confidence. You have to believe that you can. Not that you are, but that you can. And that, that then, if you then recognize that there are potentials and that you can find a dream or a passion, then that addresses the issue. And what is the picture now that is sitting in the back? And if you tell it that, this is not quite right with you, that's not right with you, that you have the confidence. And that, what I say a lot of times is that every person is unique. There's only one of you on this earth. And we all have opportunity. And even if there are challenges, the time is never too late to look at those dreams that you have or the things that can be done. But, and then I probably showed you this other book that I did. Maybe I haven't shown you yet. Is then I find a lot of times that people are not very happy, and this is what they do. You know, I heard a program on one of the major stations, CNN or somewhere like that. They said that up to 75% of the people in the United States, I believe Canada likely is the same, don't like their jobs. And 75% of those, 70% of those are looking for other jobs. And then the other part is that when I give presentations to younger people in particular, either high schools or universities, whatever it may be, is saying, okay, but what you going to do for a career? You say, well, I don't know. You know, so, well, you know, I said, respectfully, go out and check around, you know, to look at one example. Want to be a truck driver? Talk to a truck driver. Do you want to be a builder? Talk to a builder. You want to be an accountant? Talk to an accountant. See what is in that career. Or a lawyer, or a doc, or for that matter, an entrepreneur, or, you know, and a CEO. And talk to some of them. They, in a lot of cases, they like to talk to people that say, I like to know more about the benefits in your career and all those kind of things. So I wrote a book about that. It's Finding Your Passion, Living the Dream. And that's all about that part, you know, that it is so important, saying, well, hey, John, at 84, are you living the dream? I say, I sure am. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't go challenges here and there, but yeah, I am living the dream from the time that I dreamed about going to Canada, and then I dreamed about living, building a mill, and I did all of that, and everything is possible.
Yeah, it sure is, and you know, you're really talking a lot about the mindset that you have. Like, I mean, I think it's fantastic. Like, you at age of 84, you get up and you have a purpose. It's so important for a brain to have a purpose, and I mean, I think we're a lot alike in that respect. I get up and I have stuff to do. I have things that I'm grateful for. You know, it's interesting. Carol Dweck in Stanford wrote an interesting book simply called Mindset. And if anybody's listening right now that thinks, you know what, maybe I do need to change some pictures in my brain, it's a wonderful book to read. She said that learning styles, the brain tends to break down. There's many different aspects to learning styles, but one of the ones that I find very interesting is whether a person has a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. And Carol Dweck at Stanford found that it was about a 50-50 split, where some people have a fixed mindset. I am what I am. This is the way it is. Things will never change. This is how I was born. And then 50% of the population has a growth mindset. And they tend to talk to themselves differently. The most important conversations we'll ever have are the conversations that we have with ourselves.
Yeah.
And so somebody with a growth mindset says, okay, this didn't work very well, and this blew up, and I just did one big face plant here. But I can do better next time. I can learn from this. I can grow. Exactly. I can change. I can get a different result.
Exactly.
I mean, one of the ways I live my life is, you know, whatever happens right now has nothing to say about what happens next.
No.
So if something goes really great, it doesn't necessarily mean the next thing is going to go great. I have to work for that.
Exactly.
And if I have a massive failure right now, then okay, that wasn't good. Moving to the next thing, I can change. I can grow. I can have exactly. a different result.
Exactly.
So. I mean, that is just so incredibly, incredibly important.
Now, the other part that I was going to add, sorry if I interrupted you, but the other thing that I think is important is health is critical, and awareness of that, and fitness. You know, so I'm writing another book that's coming out in July, and Living Young, Dying Old. And it's about quality of life, not age. Age is just a number, but fitness is and quality of life is what counts. And so I'm That's a picture of me. Actually, I'm the oldest competitive bodybuilder in North America. And it is something that, again, I started when I had, at a time in 2008, you know, I had an altis issue that brought me this close to not making it. It was diverticulitis. And then after that, I knew I had to look at my fitness as well as in a serious way, as well as diet. And so, but then usually what I do is then I went to the gym and got a membership, not just once a year. We make these decisions, going to do this, that, that, and the other thing. And then I'll buy a membership to the gym. And then 2 weeks later, I can find 100 reasons I'm not going and anymore because I'm too busy. I didn't do that. I stayed with it because I had to. And then after 6 years, somebody said, hey, you ever thought about competing? And I said, why not? You know, so it became for me, again, as an example, using myself as the example, again, a stage in my life that I not only is it right for me in terms of fitness, but it will change effectively my life from in terms from a health and a fitness perspective. Again, where in the back of my mind, the pictures were, I'm too old for that, or maybe, you know, maybe there is a tendency to go to the negative and say, I can't do it, but rather say, no, you can, you know, that everything is possible. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Is that opportunity not available to a lot of people, even young people, when they grow up and to develop that attitude of looking forward, you know, that already, and this is probably a little bit ambitious in, say, but at least in the 40s or so, we have to decide quality of life becomes a very important part. And the other part is you, and earlier than that, you don't want to be part of the 75% that don't like their jobs. Because if you do not like the things that you do, and you take those with you, no matter where you go, because you do, you know, then that affects not only your life, but also the people that are close to you and around you.
Yeah, so incredibly well said. I believe you make a decision to be passionate, and I don't want to diminish the reality of what a lot of people are experiencing. We've been through 4 or 5 very difficult years, and it's hard. It's hard. I mean, economically, it's hard. And you flip on the news, and there's interest rates, and there's wars going on in the world, and there's health concerns. One of the things that really helps me, John, this goes back to something I think I might have learned from Stephen Covey years ago. And that is, if you kind of envision a large circle with a smaller circle in the middle, the large circle, we can call the circle of concern. These are things that are going on in the world. You know, the latest directives from the Ministry of Health, the stuff that's going on in Eastern Europe, for example, today, the Middle East, interest rates, housing costs, etc. I want to know about these things because I want to be safe. I want to keep my family safe. I want to be respectful when I move out into the community. But do I really need to just be plugged into the news all day long hearing 20 different people say the same thing over and over and over again? And so I try to limit my sort of news consumption to about 20 minutes a day. And I've got it. I know what's going on in the world. I've got a pretty good sense of it. And then I move into that sort of smaller circle in the middle, because a circle of concern, I want to know about it. I'm concerned about it, but I can't influence it. The government doesn't contact me and say, what should we do about, but I want to know. The smaller circle is where I try to spend most of my time. And that's my circle of influence. What can I read in the next 10 minutes that would help me to help somebody?
Exactly.
Who can I phone in the next 20 minutes and encourage? Do I need to get out of my office and go through that door and leave my phone behind and just go way back onto a forest here and just go out into the woods and just carry out the neural trash and just dial down the stress mechanism and think, maybe I need to go up the stairs and get a cup of tea for my wife, because she was telling me about some issues she had with her business last night over dinner, and just say, hey, I brought you a cup of tea, even though she didn't ask, and just say, I hope everything's going okay with that issue you're dealing with. I find, John, if I'm not having a good day, if my mindset has shifted more to the negative end of the bell curve, it's because I'm spending too much time in my circle of concern. I'm scrolling social media. I'm doomsday scrolling. As soon as I move to my circle of influence, it's very cathartic. It's a powerful signal to our brains that we can influence the outcome.
Very critical, Terry. I agree with you 100%. I do it a lot of times. I fly a lot, for my business, doing mm-hmm. business in the States as well here. And then we have a place in North Saanich. For our guests watching us around the world, close to Victoria, and they all know Victoria, obviously. And I spend every weekend in Victoria or North Saanich, precisely. But if I fly around, I always do that. I'm a pilot as well. But if I fly commercially, I sit by the window and I look outside. I say, I'm in paradise. I'm absolutely mm-hmm. in paradise. And then I have likely the benefit. I was born during war. We were under depression by a dictatorship of head of Hitler, and we have seen, even as a small child, I saw the results of it in our communities, and then families that lived in that kind of a setting were affected mm-hmm. by it, not only that generation, but others that followed. But what it did is the hard times likely gave me the opportunity to reflect back and appreciate as to what we have. And then the other part, again, and the bigger nucleuses and the world that I can affect, be it through my books or through my presentations that I do or through my podcasting to the world, for that matter, I can share with them the appreciation that I have for what we have compared to all the things that are going around the world. I cannot change that, but I can change the area of my circle of influence, and that's why I'm so active in terms of writing books, of giving presentations, or for that matter, this other thing I was going to quickly say as well is that, about 5-6 years ago or so, I started doing blogging to a certain extent. Then we started to do a form of podcasting on a local television station here in the region. And then COVID came, and then all of a sudden said, what are we going to do now? Now, you're familiar with Spring George, so, I have an apartment right in the center of Prince George that I bought more or less as an investment in, saying, how about the apartment? We said, well, why not create a studio and then start podcasting, broader, and then we then got connected to PodMatch, and so today we are podcasting to the world, as you do, that it is an amazing media. I do speaking in certain settings, and if I do do keynotes in the States and other places, it takes me usually 2 days or more, and it makes it very difficult. Bear here, you and me are having this conversation that you sitting in Surrey or in Vancouver, I'm sitting in Prince George. But yesterday I had talked to somebody in Texas and then somebody in Europe and all over the world. A couple of days ago, somebody in China. But as we having this conversation, we already know that tens of thousands of people are watching us. It's amazing. And that particular platform or format and podcasting as such is still in its early stages. It will still go and explode even further because it brings current dialogue that is of interest to a lot of people to the rest of the world. And I think it is amazing. And so I love it, you know, and we do a lot of it.
Well, and you're helping an awful lot of people with the work that you're doing, John. I mean, Zig Ziglar once said that you can get everything you want in life if you'll just help enough other people get what they want. Yeah. And that's a good mindset to take into the world. I'm thinking back, listening to you talk about doing podcasts. When COVID hit in March of 2020, I had never done a webinar. I'd done some podcasts as people's guests, but I'd never done a webinar. And my first reaction was like, I was having a really busy year. I was speaking all over the place. I was out of the country when this happened. And I got a phone call from my son saying, you know, Dad, I know you're out of the country. You're not paying much attention to the news, but maybe you want to just dial in and check what's going on. And so I did, and I thought, okay, I'm not going to do this. This will be over in 2 or 3 weeks, and I'll just ride it out. And it turned out it was my biggest client. I was doing a keynote, and they said, we have to shift everything online. Can you do it on Zoom? And I said, what's that? And so my first reaction was when the email came in, I know of enough not to respond right away. I went for a walk. And I just turned the picture around in my head, and I decided, okay, this is going to be a lot of work. I'm going to have to do a lot of learning. In many ways, I'm going to go back to ground zero. But this is going to be good for my brain. This is going to keep me active. I mean, I know the people that are watching are probably wondering, how does John do this? Like, he's a pilot, he's a bodybuilder, he's writing books. He's got the complexity of running a large company with all of the intermoving parts and the people stuff that goes along with that. But this is good for your brain. I mean, this is good for your brain to have these challenges. And so that mindset, I decided mentally, and you can do it that fast. It's a decision that people can make. I decided, okay, I don't like this. This is a lot of work and it's interfering in my life, but I'm actually pretty comfortable doing what I'm doing. I mean, I can do these keynotes in my sleep. I talk about, you know, leadership in the brain and health and wellness and resiliency. And this is going to be a good challenge for me because I'm going to have to learn how to do it. So as you can see, you know, I stand up when I do my stuff, and I had to build my own little studio here. And there was all kinds of opportunities that came out of that that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Because like you say, if you have to travel, I did a school in Central America. Well, there's no easy way to get from Vancouver to Central America. It would have taken 3 or 4 days, and traveling is expensive, and schools have a budget, and we're able to do it all on Zoom, and it was great. But I think it's because, you know, you and I, and I'm guessing everybody listening. I mean, I think about it, who tunes into On the Brink podcast. I mean, come on. I know who tuned. I can't see the people. I don't know who they are, but I know whoever's watching this has a good brain. I mean, who else is going to be watching a podcast at 4 o'clock Pacific Standard Time with John Brink and Terry Small? I can tell you who's, because I've done this for decades. Somebody with a really good brain, and that's good, except it's not. It becomes easy to kind of, because you do a lot of the heavy lifting earlier in your life, and then it becomes easy to kind of coast.
Yeah.
And Lord knows you're entitled to, because, you know, you've put a lot of miles in and a lot of the roads weren't paved. But that's when things can start to go wrong with your brain, is when people get comfortable.
Right.
And they stop setting goals and they stop having challenges. Exactly. And so I would really encourage everybody to who's watching, be inspired by what you're doing, John. And I'm inspired listening to you. I mean, I'm on my last quarter tank of gas, and I'm a bit younger than you, but I'm thinking, okay, hey, look what John's doing. And so it gives me incentive and encouragement to keep passionate about what I'm doing.
I want to be 120.
So where are you going to have your 120th birthday party? And am I invited? Am I invited?
Absolutely. We'll do it.
Where's it going to be?
Victoria.
Well, I was just in North Saanich, actually. I love North Saanich. I was in Sydney. And I was the keynote speaker.
And we are 5 minutes from... So let's make sure, Terry, we pretty much at the end of the show. We can go on for another hour. But I want to stay in touch with you. And Scott will make sure you have all my information. I'm going to sign the books that I have and that I'm doing. And I'm going to send them to you. And then this podcast, we will release this one tomorrow morning. So most of the time we release our podcast as we presented it. That's how it will be released. We seldom, well, we have never really made any changes to our podcast. The only time that we were thinking about editing a piece out is when we had an earthquake here and the building started shaking. And we said, oh, we'll leave that in too.
So, why not? It's one of the problems we deal with.
I love it. Terry, we could go on, but we want to stay in touch. And then, again, it was a privilege to have you on my podcast and amazing conversation.
And a huge privilege and an honor for me. And now, next time I'm up in Prince George, I know who to call for to go for a coffee or a pint.
Or go for dinner. You know, so absolutely.
I do get up to Prince George every now and then. So it's I will definitely look forward to connecting with you. And I think, you know, just for people that are listening, get curious about your brain. Talking about the brain should be as natural as talking about the weather. I send out a brain bulletin, and at the end of every brain bulletin, I make a book recommendation. I just sent a brain bulletin out 2 days ago, and it was on the brain bulletin is something I do, John, that it's a bulletin. It takes 20 seconds to read, and it is always one idea that you can do immediately to make your brain better. It could be a superfood. It could be a way to remember people's names. It could be a way to double your reading speed. So the one I just sent.
Can you share with our guest how to get it and where it is available?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is easy to remember. It's terrysmall.com. And when you go to my website, you'll see a little button that says Brain Bulletin Archive. And right below it is a field. If you decide you want to get the Brain Bulletin, it goes out to about 35,000 people all around the world. You never get any other emails from me. Your email is never shared with anybody. I do it because it's fun. It keeps me active. It keeps me learning in this field. And I've sent out about 130 brain bulletins. So there's a little button that says Brain Bulletin Archive. So if you click that, a drop-down menu will appear, and you'll be able to read all the brain bulletins I've sent out. And people seem to really like it. I just got a request today from a large, huge company. If they could reprint three of the brain bulletins in their company newsletter. And the one I just sent out was on how lavender can help somebody get a better sleep. So it was something that I tried. And I've been doing it for about a year. And I thought, you know, this is like a magic trick. It works so well for me.
My wife will love that because she is very much into natural things. And you know, also when you're on the island, we are close to Sydney, within 5 minutes from Sydney. So stay in touch with us, Terry.
Well, I for sure will. I get over to the island a lot because, as you know, there's a lot of government stuff that goes on over there. I work with them quite a bit. So,
Terry, it was a privilege, and we'll stay in touch. I'll send the books out tomorrow, and amazing podcast.
Well, thank you, John. And remember, you are a genius, and the people that are listening, you're a genius as well. Genius is the art of non-habitual thinking. And a big thank you also to Scott and Andrew, who have been great at behind the scenes supporting us and putting it all together. And
Terry, it was a pleasure. Yeah, we'll stay in touch.
Thank you for sure. All right, take care. Thank you. Bye.
Take care.